Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings toward your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings toward your family's ultimate vacation, even five times the savings toward just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.
This is the Happy News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and on Wednesday, the 25th of December, this is a collection of the most uplifting stories of 2019. There are more than you think, so settle down. We have sporting triumph for South Africa that transcends sport, heroism and quick thinking from five boys whose resourcefulness and calm under pressure saved a child in Canada, and a breakthrough typhoid vaccine. Also in this podcast, the Afghan girls whose skills in robotics are getting them attention around the world.
I would just want to show my dream to other people, and then I just want to show that girls can do anything that they want, and that's so important for us.
We have singing seals, driving rats, and a flying fat cat, and some of our listeners' most joyful moments of the year. Now, sport is sometimes more than what happens on the pitch, field, court or track. Sport can be a force that transcends divisions of race, class, wealth, religion and politics. And that was pretty much what happened in this year's Rugby World Cup. The event was held in Japan, where Japanese fans welcomed the visiting teams and supporters by learning and performing the national anthems. And although the typhoon season did cause some disruption, 20 national teams were whittled down to the two finalists, England and South Africa. South Africa prevailed, winning 32-12, and the Webb Ellis Cup was carried home by Siya Kolisi, the first black South African to lead his country's rugby team. The players were given an ecstatic welcome, as Muhammad Ali reports.
The mood was festive among the thousands who had gathered on the grand parade in front of the City Hall to welcome home the Springbok team and the golden Webb Ellis Trophy. It was quite poignant that Archbishop Desmond Tutu stood alongside the statue of a waving Nelson Mandela on the steps of the City Hall. But for today, Springbok captain Siya Kolisi was the man of the moment.
Guys, I just want to tell you this. Look how we're all different, different races, different backgrounds, and we came together for South Africa. Just take a look around you. There's different races, different people from different backgrounds, but look how you're making it special for us. So I'm saying it's time for us South Africans to stop fighting, stop arguing. Let's put South Africa first. We agree and we move forward as a country. Thank you so much, man.
While the festive mood prevailed outside, Cheslin Kolbe, who scored one of the Springboks' two tries in the final against England, reflected on the much-needed hope the team's victory has given the country.
Whatever we can do as players, we will do as much as we can to make or give a smile on a young kid, on an adult, because it's a little inches, a little pieces of like that that can really make a big difference in someone's life. And I'm sure that the rest of South Africa, from the president right down, They will lay the foundation going forward, and we really have a lot of hope in South Africa, and I'm sure that we can get stronger together. That was our motto, and that's what we believe in, and I'm positive for South Africa, and I know we will stand together.
The victory parade bus is making its way through the main streets of the city centre of Cape Town, and literally there's no place for anybody to move as people wave their South African flags, the Springbok flags. People on the balconies in the office buildings here looking out, every vantage point available to catch a glimpse of the Springbok team and the trophy.
I have not seen anything like this in the city of Cape Town since the day Nelson Mandela made his first public appearance after being released in February 1990. The joy and smiles on the faces of everyone who had come out to celebrate today was a sight to behold. And not surprisingly, the mood among those who lined the streets was particularly upbeat.
So positive. We need this. This is the best.
It makes me feel proud to be a South African. It really does. It can bring us together. You know, in this time with all of our junk status, the economy, the government, all the problems that we have here, it really does bring us together as a country. And this parade, you know, gives us a sense of pride as South Africans. You know, we are world class in this, and it's good to be South African right now.
We're all happy together. This is so nice.
And how did you feel when you saw Sia Kolisi with the...
I was so excited. I nearly jumped to the bus.
Absolutely amazing, 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 amazing.
It can do nothing else but just bring us all together as one.
As the open-top bus made its way out of the city, Capetonians will no doubt remember the positive vibes for a very long time and hope it will translate into a better future for everyone in this troubled country.
Mohammed Ali reporting from South Africa. I think he's pleased. Now, sometimes online shopping can go horribly wrong. You might order clothes the wrong size or a piece of furniture that doesn't quite fit inside your home. Well, in November, one man in New Zealand outdid us all, accidentally buying enough livestock to start a small farm. Henry Bello has the details.
Hamilton man Steve Morrow had a simple wish. He wanted to buy one singular, solitary chicken for his backyard. Instead, he got something that sounded more like this. Yes, Mr. Morrow accidentally purchased 1,000 birds rather than one. He blames the online auction advertisement written by an egg farmer who desperately needed to sell his flock before closing his farm. The post read, one thousand birds. Mr. Morrow thought that meant the highest bidder could take as many birds as they wanted. So he made a small bid and won. But it took him some time to realise his error, especially given he paid less than $1 for the entire flock. Mr. Morrow is now trying to find new homes for the birds to avoid a slaughter. So far, 700 have been saved with the help of an animal sanctuary.
That was Henry Bello, and yes, all the chickens have been found new homes since November. He checked. He wouldn't have made it into the Happy Pod otherwise. Now, when a crisis happens, what you need is quick thinking and teamwork, and that, thankfully, was in abundant supply when there was a ski lift accident on Grouse Mountain in Canada at the end of February. In video that was shared around the world, we saw the heart-stopping plight of an 8-year-old boy who had somehow slipped from his ski lift seat and was dangling high above the ground as an adult thought to be his dad desperately and precariously held on. It is clear from the video that he wasn't going to be able to do that for long, which is where our heroes come in. Five boys aged 12 to 14. They told CBC Kids News in Canada how it unfolded, starting with 14-year-old James McDonald.
I saw him first and everyone was sort of just standing around looking up at this poor kid, and so I said to the lady next to me, he's not going to be able to hold on for much longer because he was struggling. And so then I stopped Josh and told the guy to go up and get some out-of-bounds netting and hold it underneath him. Well, me and Josh went up to go grab padding. And so we took that off of this pole in the ground and then put it on top of the net.
So I got there third and I took my skis off and ran to the net to support it. And yeah, I was trying to calm him down. And then at one point, I told him to take his skis off so that he could fall without them on. He could have messed up his legs. It was, who knows what happened. It would just have been better if he was just jumping on his feet and not onto the skis.
I came down and I saw the kid. The fence was already being pulled under the kid. I popped my skis off and ran over to grab the net and pull it, give it some tension.
What we think is that he didn't get on properly.
And so he was sort of half off.
And the lift, he didn't stop the chair. She couldn't hear the screams because of the loud music. and it just kept on going higher and higher and higher until it was too high to drop him. He was really stunned, and he was just looking at his feet, and we were asking like if he was okay, and other people were asking him that too.
It's been very interesting. I was like, listen, I got in the car the other day with my dad, and then we turned on the radio, and they were talking about it. I was like, yeah, it's pretty... I don't think I realize how many people have seen it and how big it is. It's pretty insane.
That was Ethan Harvey, who was 13. And we also heard from 14-year-old James McDonald, 13-year-old Gabriel Nielsen, Sam North, who was also 13, and 12-year-old Joshua Ravensbergen. Gentlemen, we salute you. And to our friends at CBC Kids News, thank you for letting us use your interview. Now, as you know, we have been asking listeners to send in their happy stories from 2019, and we will be sprinkling them liberally through this podcast. Hang on to your hat for this one. It's an emotional roller coaster.
Hi, my name is Julian Diaz. I'm an American expat living in Cape Town, South Africa. Our good news story begins around 2015. My wife, Kate, and I began trying to have a child. And after a year of trying, naturally, we decided to consult a fertility specialist. We then, in 2016, began with artificial insemination. And after 6 miscarriages over the course of the year, we decided to give Kate's body a break. Then in September, just 2 months later, Kate found a lump in her breast, and she was then diagnosed in October with breast cancer. She underwent a double mastectomy in November, and then in December, Christmas, around Christmas, December, she began chemo. She was then declared cancer-free after the end of her chemo, but that's not the end of our story. Our story then continues because we wanted to continue with our pursuit of having a child. And unfortunately, due to the medication that Kate is on for 5 years post-chemo, she is unable to get pregnant or carry. Otherwise, it would risk the cancer coming back. One night over dinner with friends of ours said that they would love to be our surrogates. And after many discussions to make sure that this was a decision they were comfortable with, we began the surrogacy journey with them. And fortunately, in October, she became pregnant. And then even better news, in November, she called us to tell us that after a scan, she discovered that our embryo had split. So we were expecting, or she was expecting, identical twins. So in May of this year, Nina, our surrogate and wonderful friend, gave birth to our two beautiful little girls, Maria and Georgina. So after a very long journey that began in 2015, with a bit of hardship and trials, but lots of love and support from friends and from each other, our story ends with two beautiful miracles.
Congratulations, Julian, Kate and Nina, and welcome aboard, Maria and Georgina. Now, you've heard of the Beatles and the Monkees. How about the seals? Not to be confused with the Kiss from a Rose seal either. Actual, literal seals singing their hearts out. And just to make this story stranger still, could these singing seals actually help in the field of human speech therapy? Our reporter Jonathan Savage tries to make sense of it all.
The team at St Andrews University in Scotland say they were amazed. And why wouldn't they be? They managed to teach a seal to sing. 3, in fact. OK, let's see if you're equally impressed. Which legendary movie theme is this seal singing? If you guess Star Wars, you're very good. I mean, it's not exactly Frank Sinatra, you're listening to. But given the example the seal was played, it's not a bad impression for a semi-aquatic marine mammal. And here's the seal's version one more time. So what exactly is going on here? Professor Vincent Yannick is the man whose team trained 3 seals to sing up to 10 notes of their chosen pieces of music.
Other animals that can copy sounds, like whales and dolphins, produce sounds very differently from us. But with seals, it's different. They really actually use the larynx and their vocal cords and their mouth in the same way as we do when we speak. We're constantly moving our jaws, and the animals do that as well when they're modifying their sounds.
So that's how, but why? It's because these singing seals are actually guinea pigs. Stay with me, Professor Yannick says they can test different methods of human speech therapy on these fast-learning fish lovers.
What works better? What helps the slow learners to be quicker? And all those kinds of things can be answered with these animals in a way that you couldn't do with a human, simply because we, of course, grow up with our parents. We constantly exchange sounds with our parents. And that makes it very difficult to have a controlled studies on what kind of inputs actually lead to ultimately to learning and to vocal development.
So their singing isn't perfect, but neither is Bob Dylan's, and it never held him back. Science says these seals are stars. So, twinkle, twinkle.
Jonathan Savage reporting. Now, all over the world, very clever people have been diligently spending 2019 trying to improve our health and well-being. There have been some astonishing developments and breakthroughs, and our health and science correspondent James Gallagher came in to tell us about some of his favourites, starting with a new kind of cancer treatment.
This is something that's been coming for a while, and it is really clever. So if you think about most of cancer medicine, you go, I've got a breast cancer or a prostate cancer or a lung cancer or a skin cancer, and that's the basis for deciding how a person is treated. This new way of looking at cancer is called tumour agnostic therapy, and basically says, I don't care what type of cancer you have, where it is in your body. What I'm interested in is what's going on inside, in terms of the chemical pathways, the metabolism inside that cancer, because there are some things that go wrong, and they go wrong across a range of different tumours. And so the first drug has been approved in Europe. That's called larotrectinib, and it works against a specific genetic defect that appears in a range of cancers, and it doesn't matter what type of cancer it's in.
And what difference will that make to patients then?
Well, the idea is this is the movement towards highly precise, personalised medicine. And the reason why this is important is that you're giving the right drugs to the right patient. So that should be making sure the drug is more effective and it minimises side effects, because you're not giving treatment to people who don't need it. So the idea is that it will be almost a kinder form of medicine. There are more questions that will need to be answered in the long term. But at the moment, yes, revolutionary is the phrase that's being used. And it really does open up a new way of treating these kinds of tumours.
Now, there was a fantastic story in October that really captured everyone's imagination. The paralysed man who was able to move his limbs thanks to, and I hope this isn't too technical for you, a robo-suit.
Yeah, so this happened in France, and the term they prefer is exoskeleton, and I won't say that with a very ropey English version of a French accent. And I remember speaking to the man that did this. His name was Thibaut, and he described being able to move again in this robotic suit as being like the first man on the moon. It kind of like it was that big a moment for him. And the way it works is a pair of electrodes were surgically rested, requires surgery, and they rest on the surface of his brain. And a series of electrodes inside them then pick up his brain's electrical activity. And those are very rapidly sent to a computer, which has to interpret them in real time and then send instructions to the exoskeleton, so that when he thinks walk or move, then the legs start going, but he can also reach out and forward with his hands or open or close his hand. And so it's giving him the ability to interact with the world that he didn't have before. Now, at the moment, this exoskeleton is only in the laboratory. I mean, he has to be suspended from the ceiling, because if he topples over, then he can't stand up again. But they think that the same technology could be used in more useful ways earlier than getting everybody walking around in an exoskeleton. What about using the same technology in a motorised wheelchair, so that people can navigate themselves far more independently, or having an arm at home that's, say, attached to the kitchen table that means they could feed themselves or get themselves a drink and didn't require as much care? And it's all about giving independence to people who've been incredibly and profoundly paralysed.
It's incredible, isn't it? Now, there was another huge breakthrough in terms of children's health, especially. Just a few weeks ago, we were talking about a new vaccine for typhoid. First of all, why is typhoid such a big deal, and how does this new vaccine work?
Okay, I really like this story, and I think it's been described as a game changer, and I generally hate that phrase because it gets used so many times, but I think this vaccine really is a big deal. Typhoid is a disease that tends to get spread around in really poor parts of the world where you don't have access to flushing toilets, good sanitation, clean water doesn't come out of your taps in your home. And if you're listening in a Western country, you'll be, typhoid, what's that? If you're living in a poor country, typhoid is a real problem. 21 million people are affected by this disease. It's getting really hard to treat. So you would treat it with a course of antibiotics. And the problem is, typhoid is becoming incredibly resistant to antibiotics. So new options are needed, and that includes this vaccine.
And this is something that you can use even on really small children, isn't it?
Yeah, so you might be listening to this and going, wait a minute, I'm sure I've had a typhoid vaccine, and you may well have done. But the problem is, they work in people who are older and not in people who are under the age of two, who are the people who are most vulnerable to typhoid. And so the idea from the World Health Organization is to introduce this vaccine into routine childhood immunization programs. So when you get your measles jab, when you get your polio shot, you'd also be getting the typhoid one. In a trial in Nepal where they have a big problem with typhoid, it cut cases by 80%. Now, to give you the example of how rapidly this is being used and how important people think it is, let's turn to Pakistan. There they have a massive outbreak of what's called extremely drug-resistant typhoid. So big government international bodies have paid for 9 million children to be given this vaccine in an attempt to stop them dying in Pakistan. So it is a really big deal. It shows how quickly people are moving with this vaccine and how big a deal it could be around the world.
That was James Gallagher. And since I spoke to him, there's been another notable one. The Royal Marsden Hospital in England is leading a trial for another way to treat cancer. Acoustic cluster therapy uses ultrasound waves to target tumours without attacking nearby healthy cells. And that should mean fewer side effects. Good luck to them. Now, a tale of survival, resourcefulness and the value of really good, really determined friends. Amanda Eller went missing for over 2 weeks in a Hawaiian forest, and apart from a broken leg, she was found alive and in good health. Ramzan Kamali compiled this report.
The biggest thing is, you know, the last 17 days of my life have been the toughest days of my life.
Hiker Amanda Eller knows how lucky she is to be alive. She spent over 2 weeks lost in a forest on the Hawaiian island of Maui. The yoga instructor thought she was heading back to her car, but was instead wandering further and further into the wilderness.
It did come down to life and death, and I had to choose. And I chose life. I wasn't going to take the easy way out, even though that meant more suffering and pain for myself.
Amanda was rescued from a deep ravine. She waved down a rescue helicopter funded by donations. One of her friends was on that rescue helicopter.
Out of the woodwork, she comes out, arms swinging. Like, there she is. I mean, I know Amanda very well, so I was like, that's Amanda Eller. And in that split second, I was like, Amanda, how is she dressed? Oh my God, she's not wearing shoes. We gotta land this thing. Chris is like, don't jump out of the helicopter.
In order to survive, she foraged on berries. But she was also injured, a fractured leg and severe burns from the sun. Doctors say she should make a full recovery. But Amanda is most grateful for those who didn't give up on her.
I have the most gratitude and respect and appreciation. I can't even put it into words for the people that have helped me, for the people that have prayed for me.
Her mother, Julia, has called the rescue a miracle.
That was Ramzan Kamali reporting. And despite what it sounded like, Amanda wasn't actually still in the ravine. It was just an iffy Skype line. Now, do you enjoy driving? In October, we learnt that rats do, apparently. Researchers in the US taught a group of rats how to drive small plastic cars in exchange for rewards in the form of bits of cereal. After a few months, the rats learned how to change the car's direction. After the trials, all of the rats had higher levels of an anti-stress hormone. Scientists think this could be linked to the satisfaction of having learned a new skill. Dr. Kelly Lambert is the lead scientist.
So we use some old-fashioned psychology behavioral training techniques called shaping and operant conditioning. And first you have to have something the rat likes, and they like these little Fruit Loop cereal pieces that we have. We train them in baby steps. So we had the car, and initially when they would approach the car, they would get a Fruit Loop and then jump into the car and then go to the steering bars, and then they'd have to grasp the bars, and then they'd have to drive certain distances. So after a while, they knew that they had to jump in the car and drive to the Fruit Loop tree to get their reward. And then in another study, they learned to do more sophisticated steering of the car as well. It's a tiny homemade car, so we applied a motor kit to it. So we put wheels on it, and it had a little aluminum plate. And when the animal stood on the plate and grasped the bars, it completed the circuit. When it completed the circuit, it would move the car forward so that it could control. When it would release its grasp, the car would turn off. When it would grasp the bars, it would turn on. And then for the steering, we had bars on the left and the right, and they would move in the direction they wanted to steer the car, which was really interesting that they were able to do that.
Dr. Kelly Lambert. Now, time for some more of your highlights of 2019.
Hi, this is Lindsay from San Francisco, California. And the thing that made my heart sing this year, as Jackie put it, is that someone I love got a heart transplant and it saved her life. Thank you to whoever it was who donated that heart. It's just a staggering act of generosity.
My name is Pietro Romani. I live in Lisbon. This year, my great achievement was shifting careers. I've been working in contemporary dance for the past 20-odd years, and I am now shifting to be a gardener, and I'm really, really happy about that.
Hi, I'm Valerie Doze, and I'm currently studying in Salzburg, Austria, and some of the happiest moments of my study abroad experience this year have been when I've gone on runs in different parts of Europe, such as along the medieval wall in Rottenburg, Germany, and in Hyde Park in London.
Hi, my name is Sheila from California. This year, I realized my self-worth and negotiated a 42% raise with additional perks and benefits. Yay!
Yay, indeed, Sheila. And congratulations and thank you to all of you who have taken the time to get in touch with us. We will hear more later on in the Happy News Pod. You know, I've just seen the time. We are running a little long. You're okay with that, though, aren't you? I hope so, because still to come in this Happy News podcast.
You want to sing a song?
We'll hear from the nurse who gave her little drug-addicted patient a home. Now, when Sesame Street first landed on kids' TV, it was fresh, exciting, and went on to become a worldwide sensation with children everywhere. With 193 Emmy Awards in the bag and now broadcasting in 150 different countries, it hit another milestone in 2019 when the show celebrated its 50th birthday. The colourful characters of Big Bird, Elmo, Bert and Ernie, to name but a few, have delighted children and become household names over the show's 50 years. Sonia Manzano played Maria on the show from 1971 to 2015. She spoke to the BBC about her memories of the show and what it was like to be one of the first Latina characters on TV.
I was thrilled when I was cast as Maria to be a role model for kids who were like me. And it was really freewheeling and exciting. And it was a smart show, much different from everything that had been on television for children. Oscar the Grouch is my favorite. As a matter of fact, the short answer as to why I retired from Sesame Street is because 44 years was long enough for me to wait for Oscar to propose. he's by far my favorite because he's nuanced. I never knew if I was talking to an 8-year-old or a 44-year-old. He works on many levels. It was a joy to write for him because he's so negative. So you could always go to him when you needed a sense of drama.
But while the show is fun and educational, it doesn't shy away from hard topics. It's dealt with issues such as death, homelessness, even HIV. This year, it addressed the American opioid crisis and introduced a character called Carly, whose mum had a drug problem.
My mum needs help learning to take better care of herself, so she talks to people with the same problem.
Oh, well, when Elma talks about a problem that Elma's having, it helps Elma feel better.
Well, me too. And so I go to a special kids-only meeting. Our parents all have the same problem.
So what is the secret to Sesame Street's longevity and success around the world? Jo Blatt is a professor of education at Harvard University and a senior consultant on the American show.
Every time
Sesame partners with broadcasters in another country. They bring in local educators. They find out what are the issues facing children in that country. And in addition then to, you know, letters and numbers, the curriculum embraces what you really might call indigenous needs brought to it by local people. And I think that's absolutely pivotal to its success.
That was Professor Joe Blatt on the 50th birthday of Sesame Street. Now, we've already mentioned South Africa's sporting success in the Rugby World Cup and what it meant for the country, but sport is often a rich seam of inspiration. And our sports reporter Sarah Mulkerens is always there to cheer on the stars and their achievements. The phenomenon that is the gymnast Simone Biles made it into the 2018 Happy Pod as well, but she has not been taking it easy this year either.
She's 4'8". That is tiny, really, in comparison to so many people in the world. But she gets more height than anybody else ever has and probably ever could do in terms of gymnastics. She is a superstar and performs with such joy to her routines and a smile and a determination and a ferocity as well and a consistency. And, you know, this year she turned up again at the World Championships and she became the most decorated gymnast ever. She has 25 World Championship medals, 19 of them are gold. So she overtook the old previous record of Vitaly Sherbo. And you just consider that she has Tokyo next year. She just simply is phenomenal what she can do. She has four moves named after her and she's still only 22.
And I'm assuming that you have been practicing and can perform some of those moves yourself. Just describe some of those moves for us.
With Simone, it's all about her acrobatic ability. You know, when she was growing up, I think one of the first times the coaches knew she would be good was when she was on the floor as a six-year-old and she basically could bounce herself up off this floor, which wasn't, you know, elasticated or had that springy floor. And she was able to throw herself up onto her hands and her shoulders. And the coaches all just turned and looked and was like, how has this six-year-old been able to do that? Nobody else can do that. There's one in the floor that she does, which is phenomenal, that no other female competitor has ever even attempted. She's the only one who is able to do it. And, you know, there's so many warnings as well around attempting it because the amount of twists and turns she does, the height she gets, the height that she needs to get at in order to be able to complete all the rotations is phenomenal. And she does that across all the apparatuses.
She is absolutely extraordinary. Something else that we saw, the sub 2 hour marathon.
It's that mark that everybody has been talking about for so long, isn't it? Can anybody, any human, go under 2 hours for 26.2 miles? And this year we saw that broken. It was phenomenal. And it was from, you know, Eliud Kipchoge from Kenya. Now, the one thing about it is that the world record doesn't stand as such, but what Kipchoge really wanted to say, and this was the quote that was doing the round, is that no human is limited. So although it wasn't in race conditions as such, you know, there was a lot of production around it in terms of getting a really flat course. I know they even changed some of the roundabouts on the road so that the calibration was right. He had, you know, a team of pacemakers, about 40 of them, who were world-class athletes in their own right. They had, you know, they were going in a flying V to reduce all the drag. He had special shoes. But for him, and I think for a lot of people, it wasn't really about the world record. It was about seeing if it could be done in any certain conditions. It was certainly something that everybody enjoyed around the world, and specifically so those in Kenya who were reacting to it as well.
If really someone wants to go for what she wants, you can really do that if you really believe in yourself and trust in yourself.
We are happy. Everybody wants history. And he has told us he will do it. And that is why we want him and we love him.
We come here since last night waiting for this record to happen. And it has happened finally.
So a lot of pride in Eliud Kipchoge's home country of Kenya. So that was something which was incredible in 2019. And something else which I know you enjoyed, Sarah, you were there for the Women's Football World Cup.
Oh, wasn't it great? It really was. You know, I've been covering women's football for, you know, quite a while now. But I think France was just a level unlike anything that anybody ever expected. And I think it did so because you had this phenomenal American women's team who are successful and have been dominant for years and years. But they came into it also with this this kind of cultural fight that is going on around equal pay. And you had them coming in performing at their absolute peak, and you had Megan Rapinoe being so vocal and outspoken and about equal pay and the fact that they are suing their national federation because they don't believe that they are being treated equally as their male counterparts. And yet they were still able to go out onto the pitch and to perform brilliantly to go on and win back-to-back World Cups.
That was Sarah Mulcairns. Now, time for another listener.
My name is Kritika Pandey. I live in Massachusetts. The happiest thing that happened to me this year was giving my parents in India a surprise by showing up on Diwali, which is the festival of lights for Hindus. It's like the most important festival for us. It's the day in the year when we're supposed to be with family and celebrate. But I had not done that for the last 3 years because they don't have holidays for Diwali in the United States. So I remember speaking to my parents the last year on Diwali. I just got out of bed and, you know, they were all dressed up because it was evening there and the house was done up and there were oil lamps and fairy lights everywhere. And so it was really depressing for me to get out of bed to see that, you know, the other end of the world, my family is celebrating together without me. They're missing me. And so I sort of broke down on the phone and it was so bad. It was horrible. And I'd made a decision at the time that I will go home for Diwali next time, no matter what. And so I got my tickets and everything and I didn't tell anyone that I was going to go there. It's a long way, upwards of 36 hours of traveling, you know, so many trains and buses and then layovers, all of that. And I showed up on Diwali morning. My mom, she saw me and then she like shouted, like she yelled like she'd seen a house lizard or something or like a clown out of nowhere. And then she hugged me and then she started laughing and then she started crying. It's so hard to not be a Christian person and live in the United States or to basically live anywhere without your family to celebrate your most important festivals with. So, yeah, my mom was like, my Diwali is happy now. I don't need to do anything. I don't need to do up the house. I don't need to light any lamps. You're here and that's enough. It was the best thing that happened to me and my family in a very long time.
Pratika, thank you, and good wishes to anyone who's currently feeling homesick. Baby Giselle was born prematurely, weighing just under 1 kilogram. She had neonatal abstinence syndrome, caused by drugs passing from the mother to developing baby during pregnancy. Liz Smith is the director of nursing at Franciscan Children's Hospital in Brighton, Massachusetts, where Giselle was being cared for. Liz met Giselle 2 weeks after finding out she couldn't have a child herself. She fostered Giselle and later legally adopted her. Ben James spoke to Liz and Giselle about their journey.
You want to sing a song?
Well done. Fantastic. And I read that that was her favourite song in the newspaper piece as well.
It is.
What a great singer for how old, 2? Yeah.
She's 2. She'll be 3 in July.
She's not far off 3. Well, fantastic to meet her and fantastic to meet you. Could you just take us back to the time when you first set eyes on Giselle, that moment?
Sure. We'll never forget it. I was talking to a few of the nurses. I had just started my position as the director of nursing. Another nurse was starting to foster a patient, and they had asked me if I had met Giselle. And I said, no, why do you ask? And they said, you two would just be the perfect pair. And they had no idea that I was going through IUI and thinking about in vitro fertilization. And so I thought it was funny they mentioned it, not even knowing me or my strong desire to become a mom. I put it in the back of my mind, and then 2 weeks later was walking out of our inpatient medical unit, and this nurse was pushing this beautiful baby in a stroller, and she just caught my eye, and I said, who's this beautiful baby? She's a little angel, and she said, this is Giselle, and I looked at her big blue eyes, and that was it. It was something inside me just clicked, and a day didn't pass where I didn't go see her after that. It's hard to explain it, but in that moment, I knew how much she needed me, and I knew how much I needed her at the same time. And it just felt right.
Where had she come from? Why did she end up in hospital? Was she found by someone? Was she left there?
No, so she was born prematurely, less than 2 pounds. She was born at a pound, 14 ounces. She was born with neonatal abstinence syndrome, which is withdrawing from narcotics, opiates. And that, in combination with her prematurity, set her up with a lot of medical challenges. So she was in the neonatal ICU for 3 months, and then she was transferred to Franciscan Children's for acute rehab, where they focused on further pulmonary rehab and feeding therapies.
And during that time, I understand that she wasn't getting any visitors.
Right. She really wasn't. It was remarkable because her lawyer, who I got to know down the road, said, I walked in her room and said, oh my gosh, she must have so many visitors. And the nurses sadly shook their head. And she had a few supervised visits with her parents, but they were sporadic. But outside of that, no, nothing.
When did you first take her home?
About 3 weeks after I had met her. So it happened quickly. And it was 2 weeks before I met her was when I got the news that I wouldn't be able to get pregnant on my own. So I went from this devastating kind of door shut to motherhood to 6 weeks later, you know, bringing this beautiful baby home. But quickly, in the first couple weeks, I just remember a change, and that she would look at me in a different way. And it was almost like she knew I was her person, and I was going to keep her safe, and I was loving her, and couldn't love her more, even if I had carried her.
That was Liz Smith, mother of Giselle. Now, if rats can drive, why shouldn't cats fly? Last month, we learnt about Viktor, the Russian moggy who fell foul of the airline Aeroflot, and how what seemed to be a perfect plan to sneak him onto a flight went catastrophically wrong. I'm sorry, the puns don't get any better. Here's our Moscow correspondent, Steve Rosenberg, with the tale.
When Mikhail Galin tried to check his portly puss, Viktor, onto a flight from Moscow to Vladivostok, his fluffy friend weighed in at 10 kilograms. By Aeroflot rules, that's 2 kilograms too heavy to be in the cabin. But the thought of 8 hours in the hold, well, it's enough to give you kittens. So Mikhail hatched the perfect plan. He hired a body double of his cat, a more slimline, slightly less clunky kitty, to trick Aeroflot. Boarding pass in hand, a surreptitious swap was performed, and Mikhail and his feline made a beeline for the plane. All good, but then catastrophe. After the flight, Aeroflot spotted Mikhail's Facebook post admitting the deception, and it didn't pussyfoot around. For making a mockery of their rules with his moggy, the airline took away all Mikhail's air miles. The decision has sparked outrage on social media and a wave of sympathy for the passenger and his pet. Speaking to me from Vladivostok, Mikhail admitted he was at fault, but he said he'd felt morally bound to save his cat from the hold and a fate worse than death. And Aeroflot, he added, could have been just that little bit more flexible. Just a whisker.
That was Steve Rosenberg. Now, here are some of the other stories we enjoyed this year. Sarah Thomas, the woman who was treated for cancer a year ago and in September became the first person to swim the English Channel 4 times. It should have been about 130 kilometres, but because of strong tides, it was nearer 209 kilometres. It took her 54 hours in the water. Brava to her. In February, the USAF and RAF both took part in a flypast over the English city of Sheffield to honour 10 American airmen who died when their plane crashed in a park 75 years ago. The commemoration came about because of 82-year-old Tony Folds, who was a boy when the plane crashed and has for decades tended the memorial to the men, and Dan Walker, a BBC TV presenter who began an online campaign after chatting to Tony in a park. And hail to the Spanish doctors who revived a British woman who had suffered a cardiac arrest that lasted 6 hours. Audrey Schumann fell unconscious when she was hiking with her husband in the Pyrenees in a snowstorm. By the time rescuers arrived, her body temperature had fallen to half the normal level. They used a machine to remove her blood, infuse it with oxygen, and then reintroduce it. Once her body temperature had increased, they used a defibrillator to restart her heart. Now, another chance to hear from some of our lovely listeners who took the time to send us messages.
Hello, my name is Khaled Fellah. I am from Tripoli, Libya. My best moment this year is the first time I went live on air as a radio presenter. It's a really dream came through. Being blind made me a big fan of radio since my childhood. I've always thought of working on this gadget. I almost broke down in the first 5 minutes of live broadcasting, but luckily I was strong enough to cope with the occasion.
This is Meltem making this recording from Barcelona. Well, the happy, happy news of 2019 from me and my partner is that we are pregnant. So this is the best way to end the year.
My name's Drew Edwards. I live in Aberdare in South Wales. My happy thing was that I ran my first Cardiff Half Marathon, but I was also a run leader for the Run 100 Club, which is an initiative by Run Wales, the Welsh Athletics Social Running Programme, and Run for Wales, and also Women's Health. So 100 Club supported 100 women who were new to the half marathon distance. It was such an amazing experience supporting them over 4 months. And considering I only started running in August 2018, I think these are major achievements and really were the happy times of my 2019.
Hi, I'm Saloni. I was born in India and raised in Thailand. I promise this is relevant. In 2019, I was given a conditional offer to study medicine at the University of Edinburgh. I met the conditional and now I'm here in Edinburgh, which is very exciting and scary. It was quite a culture shock, but the city is amazing and I'm so lucky and grateful to be here.
My name is Sam Oppenheim. I'm calling you guys from Flushing, Queens, New York City. My happy memory from this year would be when I was on a field trip. I'm a public school social studies teacher, and I was leading 25 young students in the sixth grade through the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and twice, complete strangers, one was a security guard and one was a visitor to the museum, both told me that they really appreciated how I was teaching my students, what I was choosing to say to them. That made me feel like I was valued in the job I was doing. Feeling like what you do for a living is valued by society brings me happiness and joy.
Hello, my name is Dovnyak Armin. After living 19 years as an immigrant in Belgium, I finally got the Belgian nationality. And I also earned a master's degree in translation. It was a really colorful year for me.
Hello, my name is Makisha. I'm a Londoner living in New York. My happiest moment of 2019 was when I went on a trip for what I thought was a quiet week with my best friend who had recently moved to Jamaica. Only when I got to Jamaica, my entire family and some of my friends were there to surprise me for my 40th birthday. My parents and sister and her family were there from London. I had family who had flown in from New York, Atlanta, Miami, my uncle from DC who hasn't left the country in 30 years. It was absolutely amazing. Thank you again and again, my wonderful friends and family.
Now, Afghanistan has been in a state of conflict for decades, and this story focuses not on the strife, but on hope for the future and on the women who are trying to change their country for the better. The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, went to the western province of Herat, where she met some teenagers, the all-women Afghan robotics team, who have been winning prizes and praise from Dubai to Washington, D.C.
My name is Sagar Salehi. I'm 15 years old. I was interested in robotics since I was 8 years old because I liked physics and mathematics very much.
When I was 6 or 7, I was so curious about how a piece of metal can do anything that human cannot do it. And now I know how to build a robot or how to do the mechanical that I love.
These are some members of the Afghan all-girls robotics team who last year went to the United States and caused a sensation when they won the silver prize at an international robotics competition. And they went on to win many awards since, asking many people, how does an all-girls team from Afghanistan, a country at war in a very conservative culture, succeed like this?
I'm doing the software part of the robot, programming it to work by itself.
Now I'm working on rollers so that robot can go up.
And do you still face obstacles along the way when you ask to travel abroad, when you spend so much time working in your laboratories here?
My mom always says that for outside our cities, you cannot go because the security is not good. But what I'm saying is I would just want to show my dream to other people. And then I just want to show that girls can do anything that they want. And that's so important for us.
And has the war had a direct impact on your life?
Actually, we are just getting used to with the situation in Afghanistan. And we are just doing our best to achieve our goals.
And you're also looking at how to help your country with some of the robots you're developing?
Actually, we are just having the idea to build some drone machines, which are for finding the mines and mark them for clearing the mines. So this robot will help us for security part of Afghanistan, and it would be one of the part of our dream to change something in Afghanistan.
So this would be demining, you hope, at a time of peace.
Yeah, absolutely. One day we're going to just have the peace in Afghanistan, yeah.
You have no doubt.
No.
Lise Doucette with the all-women Afghan robotics team. Now, names come in and out of fashion, and I say this as someone whose own first name hasn't been inflicted on a child since about 1980. And this year, a pub landlord named Nigel Smith saw in a government report that his name was becoming something of a rarity. So he organised what he hoped would be the largest gathering of people called Nigel. Richard Hamilton reports.
The name Nigel is now considered so old-fashioned that publican Nigel Smith has announced there'll be a Nigel night at his pub in Bretforton. He says he wants to have a gathering of Nigels before they become extinct and to try to set a new world record.
To get the world record for the largest number of people with the same name in the same place, it's 2,300 or so, or a little bit more, which is held by the name Ivan in Bosnia-Herzegovina from 2017. So if we do that, we will have to get the place expanded a little bit and find some additional Nigel car parking, otherwise things might get a bit tricky.
In 2016, there were so few babies named Nigel that it was removed from the Office for National Statistics list, which excludes any names given to two or fewer children.
I often ask my mum why I was called Nigel.
The football commentator, Nigel Adderley, told me what it's like being called Nigel.
She said she thought it would be good I had a name which nobody else had at school. When I went to school, XTC brought out a song called Making Plans for Nigel. We're only making plans for Nigel. Which seemed to depict a character called Nigel as fairly hopeless. That really didn't help me. I can't think of a reason why you would call your son Nigel now unless you wanted to belittle them.
And did you ever try to change your name?
No. I believe that once I was given the name Nigel, it was a cross I had to bear. And when I speak to other Nigels, I think there's a fairly strong bond. We know it's an issue, but we've all had to deal with it. And I've never considered changing my name because if you do that, people will inevitably ask, what was your original name? You'll say it was Nigel. And they'll consider you to be a Nigel as a noun, and that's never a good thing.
The word Nigel derives from the Irish Nile, meaning champion. It then made its way south to France and entered England at the time of the Norman conquest. Nigel Night will be held on Saturday, the 28th of September. Real Nigels will have to prove their identity. Non-Nigels are welcome to attend, but will have to wear a badge explaining that they're not Nigel.
That was Richard Hamilton, definitely not Nigel. 433 Nigels attended the gathering, including one who flew all the way from the US. Now time for more of you.
Kia ora, my name is Sally Lavin. I live in New Zealand in a wine-growing region called Martinborough, from where I'm speaking to you today as I walk among the vines listening to BBC podcasts, including the Global News podcast, which I really enjoy. I just wanted to let you know about one of my happiest moments this year, and that was out walking with the family on one of New Zealand's iconic walks, the Milford Track in the South Island. Thank you very much for all the work you do. Really enjoy it. Have a great Christmas.
Hi, my name is Anne. I'm in New York. And what made 2019 sparkle for me was arriving in Santiago de Compostela after walking for a month on the Camino in Spain.
Hi, my name is Lena. I am from Cologne, Germany. And the thing that made me most happy in 2019 was to realize that I was equally happy leaving home to go travel, to live abroad in Spain and Canada and the States, and then also coming back home, being just as happy to be back. So this balance of just, you know, the comfort of home and the thrill of new experiences, that really made me happy.
This is Kim Blake speaking from the Northwest Arm, Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I've managed to kayak every month of the year, including through ice in January and February and March. And this is my happy place. I'm proud of this. And I listen to, on my headphones, the BBC World Service. Happy Christmas.
She literally recorded that in a kayak. I have tweeted the video. Australia next.
Hi, Jackie. This is Kat Woods from Melbourne, Australia. Two highlights of my year. First of all, Jackie Leonard recording the voice message for my message bank.
Yeah, I did do that. She tweeted and asked. More to the point, though.
And most of all, the arrival of my little cavoodle pup, Luca, and I will send a photo through. Thanks, Global News.
You're welcome. And yes, I have tweeted a photo because Luca is a worthy Global News pet. And finally...
My name is Kipum Chong, and I'm from South Korea. The one thing that made 2019 sparkle for me was getting married to this wonderful British guy called Scott Shepherd.
And it was Scott's birthday on Christmas Eve, so a very happy birthday to you, Scott. And if your heart isn't warmed through by now, you might be beyond help, but try this for size. The five-year-old boy from the US state of Michigan who invited his entire kindergarten class to his final adoption hearing. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
When five-year-old Michael found out he was being formally adopted, he wanted all his friends there for the occasion, saying they were his family too. Videos show him dressed in a red bow tie and navy waistcoat, sitting next to his adoptive parents at Kent County Court in West Michigan. Behind them, something you don't normally see in a courtroom, a large group of small children. They waved red and pink paper hearts and explained why they wanted to come. One boy called Stephen said Michael was his best friend, while a girl called Lily said she loved him. The judge, who was wearing a necklace made out of Christmas decorations, let Michael bang the gavel to complete the adoption process, prompting this reaction from his friends and teachers. After the hearing, Michael and his dad spoke to a local journalist.
This process has been amazing. We've been working with Catholic Charities and the workers there have just been amazing.
I love my daddy! Love my daddy so much.
Michael's case was finalised on Kent County's Adoption Day, with another 37 children officially welcomed into their new families.
That was Charlotte Gallagher. And that's it from us for now, but normal service will be resumed in the Global News podcast tomorrow. As ever, our email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. A huge thank you to all the listeners who shared their personal happy stories with us, including the ones who made me cry. I'm sorry we couldn't use them all, but you have provided some much-needed therapy to the Global News podcast team, and we are most grateful. The Happy News Pod producer was Morgan Eyre. The studio manager was Julian Miller. I'm Jackie Leonard. From all of us here at the BBC World Service, if you are celebrating, Merry Christmas, and whether you are or not, we wish you peace and joy. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.